Well, we're back, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Peter Flaherty. Hello, Peter, and welcome again to Talking Travel.
Hi, Bob. I'm glad to be back on the show, and this sounds like it's going to be a very interesting new segment that we're starting today.
Well, we'll see. Time will tell. So here we go. It's called Talking Travel Literature. And the book is called The Art of Travel by Alain de Botton, who is a Swiss-born writer and academic. He has a degree in history from Cambridge. He also happens to be one of the most eclectic writers I've encountered in a long time. And Peter, you were the one who put me onto this terrific book, and I think we would both agree that it is really a super book. So why don't you start and tell our listeners what the book is all about and what you think de Botton is doing in this book?
Well, Bob, I guess the first thing I should maybe clear up with the listeners is what the book isn't. Everybody who likes to travel likes to read travel guides and books that tell you about destinations you might want to go to or might like to even imagine going to, and that's not really what de Botton is doing in this book. It's not a conventional travel guide, as he titles it, The Art of Travel. When I read it, I thought it could also be titled The Philosophy of Travel or even The Psychology of Travel. He's really trying to talk about the experience of travel, what it's like to get on a plane or board a train and go somewhere, and all of the things that you notice and sense in yourself through the experience of travel, even before you get to the destination. He does talk about a number of different places that he visits, and for each one he kind of couples it with a famous writer or someone who's either been there or been somewhere else that somehow resonates with where he's going. I actually picked the book up on a recent trip to New York, and I really enjoyed reading it while I was going down there and while I was coming back on the plane. He has a wonderful section about the experience of getting on a plane and just sensing the takeoff and knowing that you're leaving one place and going to another place. He's got a marvelous way of kind of making things that would seem really quite mundane, the things about travel that many people might find to be the least interesting or even kind of irritating, like waiting in airports or railway stations or dealing with all of the frustrations of travel. But he enjoys them because he sees this as all part of the experience of travel.
Okay, well, let's start there, because one of the first points in the book that resonated for me was when he goes out to Heathrow Airport, and he just sits there in one of the terminal buildings watching planes take off. And he talks about the takeoff, and he says there is psychological pleasure in this takeoff too, for the swiftness of the plane's ascent is an exemplary symbol of transformation. The display of power can inspire us to imagine analogous, decisive shifts in our own lives, to imagine that we too might one day surge above much that now looms over us. So obviously he's, as you said, he's being very conceptual, very philosophical, but he also, in the book, becomes very pragmatic and practical. And can you tell me, how does he get from that philosophical, conceptual statement to the practicalities?
Well, that section, that's interesting. When I read that part about watching the planes take off and land, it reminded me of when I was a kid in Toronto. My parents used to drive us on a Sunday afternoon out to the airport to watch the planes. And many people did that, and people who probably during that period of time couldn't really afford to get on a plane or go anywhere. And it was kind of a vicarious experience of travel. And what de Botton is talking about there, I think, is the idea that these planes have taken off from far distant places and are landing in London after traversing the world and bringing with them people who, for whatever reason, have decided to get on a plane that day. It's a marvelous image of transformation in a technological sense, that now we live in a world where it's possible just to board a plane and be halfway around the world a few hours later. But at the same time, I think he's hinting at this idea that somehow travel, if you're open to the experience of it, it can really change your life. I know that sounds kind of pop psychology, maybe a little bit cliche, but the potential of personal growth, of personal transformation, of seeing the world in a different way through the experience of travel, I think this is all part of what he means by the art of travel, and how if you're sensitive to it and the things that it can teach you, it really can make you a different kind of person. And I personally find that really resonates with me when I travel,
And of course, the kind of traveling he does in this book is right around the corner. And you'll remember the point where he's driving along one of the motorways and he stops at a service station with this cheap motel next to it. And he simply sits there and starts to indulge in what he calls word painting. And I'm going to quote this piece and ask you to comment on that. And he says, if we find poetry in the service station and the motel, if we are drawn to the airport or train carriage, it's perhaps because in spite of their architectural compromises and discomforts, in spite of their garish colors and harsh lighting, we implicitly feel that these isolated places offer us a material setting for an alternative to the selfish ease, the habits and confinements of the ordinary rooted world. So what's he telling us there?
Well, I think I'm going to remember that the next time I'm sitting somewhere I find particularly boring, if it's in a different country, to be open to the experience of difference and even the exotic. I mean, de Botton is able to find exotic and interesting things in what we might consider to be the most mundane places, like railway stations or restaurants and service stations on highways. One thing I should add to the listeners, the book, one of the really good features of the book, or of the many I found, is the fact that there are very interesting reproductions of paintings, some by 19th century artists, but I think the ones that he uses to illustrate this point about finding the exotic in the mundane are some very haunting and evocative paintings by an American artist named Edward Hopper, who traveled around the United States in the 30s and 40s painting people in restaurants and people pumping gas in service stations. And they're mundane, and yet they're, as I say, haunting and almost philosophical in what he's able to express. And I think this is what de Botton is trying to get at, that you can find yourself in a place that you might otherwise feel to be completely lacking in interest, but if you're sort of open to the details. And the word painting you talked about, as a travel writer, it's something I try to do. I'm not sure that I'm as accomplished as de Botton is, but instead of just the sort of the postcard way of describing your travels, having a great time, weather is great, weather is lousy, the scenery is beautiful, that's really not enough. When he refers to the great English 19th century writer John Ruskin as kind of his guide for this, that when you are writing, when you're trying to describe something, you should really put yourself to the effort of trying to get the most exact and precise and vivid description of what you're seeing. And that way, even if you're writing something about something that might be kind of boring, like sitting at a railway station, you can capture some details that will engage the reader and make you feel like you're somewhere different.
And you've already mentioned the part in the book when he arrives at Amsterdam's Schiphol Airport, and he spends some time just talking about the sign hanging from the ceiling that announces the ways to the Rivals Hall. And for him, that sign provokes pleasure in part because it offers the first conclusive evidence, as he says, of having arrived elsewhere. And so that sign is a symbol of being abroad. At one point in the book, too, a point that I really enjoyed, too, when he, as you said, he goes on virtual journeys, if you like, with famous writers in the past, and the French writer Flaubert is one of them, who went to Egypt, which in those days they called the Orient. De Botton, in reference to Flaubert, says that what we find exotic abroad may be what we hunger for in vain at home. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I think that was probably true in the case of Flaubert. He grew up in a very provincial bourgeois town in France and hated every moment of it, and as a young boy was determined to get out of there and see the world and experience as much as possible of it as soon as he could. And many of us have probably felt that way. Now, we don't all become Flauberts, but in the 19th century, of course, to many Europeans like Flaubert, the Orient was the other. It was an exotic place. It was a place where all kinds of delights and sort of pleasures of the flesh, if you will, could be sampled that were certainly frowned on back home in the Europe of that time. And Flaubert went to Egypt. It was a major undertaking in those days. It was certainly a trip not for the faint-hearted. But I think what the Breton is holding up as an example of someone like Flaubert is a real intrepid traveler as opposed to a kind of a mass tourist. This book is very good in the sense that it gives you a kind of a history of travel, too. So besides being a philosophy and a psychology, it's also a kind of a neat history of how mass tourism began. Really, during the same period that Flaubert was going to Egypt, the first Cook's tours were being organized by a guy named Thomas Cook, who was taking religious people to see the sites of the Holy Land. And there's a very nice juxtaposition, I think, that de Botton makes between the kind of traveler Flaubert is and the mass tourism of the Cooks of the world who continue to dominate the travel business today.
And I think that's really important, obviously, for all travel writers. I like the point, too, where he comments that, and I'll quote again, the danger of travel is that we see things at the wrong time, before we've had a chance to build up the necessary receptivity. And when new information is therefore as useless and fugitive as necklace beads without a connecting chain. But I think what he teaches us is that is this whole issue of being receptive to the new place. And I liked the point that you just made about the Cook's tour, because it really was the effect of urbanization that got mass travel going. And this was, as he points out, that in the second half of the 18th century, city dwellers really began for the first time to travel in great numbers through the countryside in Britain. And that was to restore health, but also harmony to their souls, as he calls it. And the statistic that in 1700, only 17% of the population of England and Wales lived in a town, but by 1900, it was 75%. So you do have a kind of exodus from the cities. I want to talk a little bit about, and the whole book really is about travel and perception, but especially in the part of the book where he writes about Van Gogh, who obviously is in the south of France painting Provence in a much different way from the way in which other people have painted it. And de Botton says that Van Gogh insisted that most had failed to do justice to their subjects. They had not, he claimed, produced realistic depictions of Provence. And according to de Botton, the world is complex enough for two realistic pictures of the same place to look very different depending on an artist's style and temperament. Well, what are the implications of that statement for A, a travel journalist, and B, a traveler?
Well, I really like the section on Van Gogh in Provence. I'm certainly not an art historian, but through illustrations, he shows you how Van Gogh was able to capture the kind of the existential quality of cypress trees in a way that people have been painting Provence for many years before Van Gogh went there, and he just saw things in a very different way, I think, because of his ability to allow himself to experience his subject matter. Remember that at this time, photography had been developed, and artists were really wrestling, the impressionists particularly, with the idea of capturing reality in a different way than a photograph would. Now, when that comes to travel writers, I think that this is where his notion of word painting really comes in again. I mean, you're seeing the same thing that many other people have seen. The travelers, for instance, who go to Rome and wander through the Colosseum or the Forum, millions of people have been there, and many people have written about it. But if you're really a travel writer who's trying to do the kinds of things that de Botton is suggesting, I think the onus is on you to capture something different about it, whether it's your own personal reaction to it or some detail that hasn't maybe been noticed before, or how other people are experiencing it while they're seeing it with you. So I think both as a travel writer and a traveler, you want to be trying to capture a unique experience and not just fall into a mass market kind of approach to consuming historic sites or interesting places that people visit.
And he really does teach us how to be detached, but at the same time, an engaged observer. And you may remember the piece in the book where he's in Madrid, And it's at night, and a couple of blocks from his hotel, there's this, it's a bit of waste ground with apartment buildings and a petrol station and a car wash. Really a nothing area in Madrid. But he goes out in the evening in the darkness, and he turns what he sees into a metaphor, because there's a train going by, passing by apartments, and in those apartments people are watching television, and in the train people are traveling, but they're having their dinner or whatever. So you've got, it's the proverbial ships that pass in the night. In the book he spends a fair amount of time dealing with beauty and the nature of beauty as well. And he quotes Ruskin. Tell us who Ruskin is, first of all.
Well, John Ruskin was a 19th century writer and art historian in England who, I guess his most famous book would be The Stones of Venice, where he really was fascinated with Gothic architecture and art, and his book on Venice probably became one of the most famous literary travel guides of its time. I mean, all kinds of English tourists clutched it with them while they toured through the Piazza San Marco and tried to appreciate the architectural wonders of Venice.
And de Botton points out that Ruskin arrived at five central conclusions in terms of the nature of beauty. And the first of that is that beauty is the result of a complex number of factors. In other words, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But that it affects the mind psychologically. Secondly, he says that humans have an innate tendency to respond to beauty and to desire to possess it. And that's the part that I found really interesting. But he says there's only one way to possess beauty properly, and that's through understanding it. And also that the most effective way of pursuing this conscious understanding is by attempting to describe beautiful places through art. In other words, the art of traveling. De Botton also goes on about how Ruskin was so distressed by how seldom people notice details. And he said he deplored the blindness and haste of modern tourists. And he makes reference to the Cook tours that you made reference to, and the fact that, and Ruskin connected the wish to travel fast and far to our often inability to derive appropriate pleasure, this is a quote, appropriate pleasure from any one place, and by extension, from the tiny details in the place. And it's actually quite funny because in 1864, Ruskin was talking to an audience of wealthy industrialists in Manchester, and he harangued them about the fact, and he said, your one conception of pleasure is to drive in railroad carriages. This reminds me of charter flights to all those beaches. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, it also reminded me of bus tours that people board and go through maybe 10 countries in Europe in a week. I mean, there was a movie made quite a few years ago called If It's Tuesday, This Must Be Belgium. And that really captures the sense that many people have that they want to cram in as much experience as, and I think really the word is consume it, without really digesting it, without really having any sense of where they are, what they're seeing, the details. They say the devil's in the details, but I think that the great pleasure can be derived from details too. But you need to work at it. You need to be an informed traveler and understand a bit what you're seeing before you are really able to appreciate it to its maximum.
And if I can come back to the word painting issue again, you know, remember the point in the book where he's back in London and it's night, he's downtown, and he's looking at several tall buildings. And he actually turns the scene inside out and shows how looking at London at night is a completely different travel experience from looking at London during the day. And he says, night drew attention to the facets of the offices that were submerged in the day. Lit by the sun, the offices could seem normal. They repelled questions as effectively as their windows repelled glances. But night upsets this claim to normality. And I think what, if he encourages us to do anything as travelers, it's to do it in the, if you like, abnormal way. Another point that I wanted to bring up, because it's an issue that the traveling public may not be too aware of, but as travel journalists, and we often talk about this, there's a phenomenon that we refer to in various terms, but one of the terms is the reentry angst, or the reentry dilemma. And this happens to Breton, because he goes on a holiday to Barbados, and it takes him a while to readjust his frame of reference and to learn how to really see beyond the obvious there. And then he comes home to rainy London, and almost petulantly, I love this part, he says, "I returned to London from Barbados to find that the city had stubbornly refused to change. I had seen azure skies and grand sea anemones, etc., but the hometown was unimpressed. It was still raining." And he points out that when we are in a good mood and it is sunny, it is tempting to impute a connection between what happens inside and outside. And of course, you know, there's nothing like a bit of bad weather to spoil the trip or to change your perceptions. But what he recommends is you use those a rainy day to see it differently. And it's all about the mindset. And this is when he talks about the you'll have to tell me who this is, de Maistre, a French writer. And who is that?
Xavier de Maistre is the person he's referring to, who did this kind of neat exercise of writing the voyage around his bedroom by day, describing all the minutiae of his domestic arrangements by day, and then he did not to be.
Wait a minute. Why would he do a journey around his bedroom?
Well, I think he wanted to prove that it's possible to be a travel writer even in the most the smallest and most confined circumstances. And then he did a sequel called Journey Around My Bedroom at Night, to show, illustrate the point I think that de Breton is trying to make about how he observes the buildings in London at the Canary Wharf at night and sees them in a very different way than he would understand them if he were to see them by day.
And de Breton says, if only we could apply a traveling mindset to our own locales, we might find these places becoming no less interesting than the high mountain passes and butterfly-filled jungles of Humboldt, South America. So how does that mindset develop?
I think curiosity and openness are the key features that you need to at the outset. And at the very end of the book, de Breton, he tries many of these different experiments in travel writing. He's not really very good about describing his room, although there is a picture and it shows you his books and his bed and some of the furniture. But he goes around his neighborhood one afternoon and just sort of walks the streets of Hammersmith, which is a suburb of London, and notes the cars and trucks going by and the people going about their business, and really tries to do this word painting exercise to bring a fairly mundane and everyday scene to life and make it interesting. And you know what? Like so many other parts of the book, I'm reading it and I'm thinking, he's really talking about fairly obvious things, but he's describing them in such a way, that in an interesting way, that I hadn't really experienced in travel journalism before. I mean, we tend to pick up travel books. Literary travel is a big section in the bookstores now. People want to read about faraway places, some of the places he talks about in the book, and some of the people who went on these epic journeys. You mentioned von Humboldt, who's kind of a personal travel hero of mine. I mean, here was a guy who went all through South America in the early 19th century, when it was practically impossible to get to some of these places. He was probably the first European to actually see some of the wonders and sights that he. But he was an extremely curious man who was interested in everything and wanted to not only possess beauty, but to possess the knowledge that only travel, first-hand experience of seeing these places and learning about the flora and the fauna and how the people lived in a way that no one else had really done before. But whether it's your bedroom or the streets of London or taking on an epic journey all through South America, I think if you're a curious person, if you're open to new experiences, and if you come with an open mind and really accept the place that you're in as different. I think many people, when they travel, make the mistake of assuming that they can expect things to be different and yet the same as what they're used to back home. I mean, we make all kinds of jokes about the tourists who get upset when things aren't quite the way they're used to them back home. But it's a cliche, but it's really a very important point.
It's also called ethnocentrism, too.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's something that, you know, unfortunately in this age of mass travel and with globalization, we're finding that you go to places that you hope will be very different and very other. I mean, I was struck in the Centro Storico, the old historic center of Rome, you know, where there are McDonald's. I mean, they've kept them fairly low key. You don't have big golden arches dominating the skyline, but they're still there. They're probably useful if you need to use the washroom, but I mean, I'm always amazed that people, when I've been in Europe, noticing that people tend to go to, and not everyone, flock to the things they're used to and the food they're used to. But for me, the whole experience of travel is negated by that. I mean, when you go somewhere different, you want to really experience difference.
Okay, very last question and comment. To me, art is something that transcends, that goes beyond a certain point. And I'm going to leave the last comment to you. So why is travel an art form?
Why is travel an art form? Well, I think you can make it creative, and I'm certainly not an artist. I try in my travel writing to capture a picture of something, a sense of a place. I think that really is an art, and some people are good with words, some people can take wonderful photographs, some people can just narrate stories of their travel experiences, but whatever form you choose, I think that is an artistic talent, it's an artistic ability, and just getting on a plane and going somewhere can be an artistic, creative experience. If you allow it to be that for you and not fall into this other pole of being a tourist and being a consumer of places and things. So I think anyone interested in really experiencing travel and enjoying travel as an art form can't go wrong by picking this book up. I would strongly recommend it.
Okay, thanks very much, Peter, and I hope we get to do this again.
I hope so, too. There's lots of travel books to the travel literature to review, so I look forward to it, Bob.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.